I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in for Leonard Lopre today. Joyce Carol Oates has been called one of the most quintessentially American of writers. She's also one of the most prolific, so it made sense to choose one of her books for the Leonard Lopre Show Book Club. Her 2007 novel, The Gravedigger's Daughter, was a New York Times bestseller and was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. It tells the story of Rebecca, the daughter of a mathematics teacher and a pianist who flee Nazi Germany in 1936 and settle in a small town in upstate New York. The father can only find work as a gravedigger and cemetery caretaker. And the book includes life-changing violent, but also promise of creating a new life. The Gravedigger's Daughter is published by Echo, and I'm very pleased that Joyce Carol Oates is here today to talk about the book. Welcome.
Thank you.
We're inviting our listeners to join the conversation, too. If you have a question for the author, you can call us at 212-433-9692 or leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Now, you dedicate this novel to your grandmother, Blanche Morgenstern, whom you call the Gravedigger's Daughter. Can you talk about that dedication and your grandmother?
Well, the novel was very difficult emotionally for me to write. I couldn't really write it until my parents had died, my grandmother had died quite a few years before, because there's so many personal elements in it. At the same time, it is fiction, and I've sort of invented a story that would dramatize many of the elements of my grandmother's life that were probably latent rather than actually dramatized. She was a wonderful woman. She was the quintessential grandmother. She lived for her family. She loved me very much. And maybe she spoiled me a little. She gave me my first typewriter, including, when I was really young, a toy typewriter. So
she gave you a toy typewriter.
One of those toy typewriters. Wow. Where you move the circle around with the letters on it, and then you press it down. So it would take you a long, long time to write a novel.
Even a word, right.
Right. So that grandmother's always been bound up in my whole life with books and with the imagination and going to school and things like that. It was revealed that long after she died that she was a German Jew. Her family came over in the 1890s, and they'd had a very disastrous experience, and her father had tried to kill her, actually, but he didn't.
Oh my goodness. Killed
himself. I mean, it was all like a real story.
So those moments in the story, which are the violence I found in your story, where the father kills the mother and then tries to kill the daughter but doesn't and kills himself.
Yes.
It's violence that isn't the kind of violence that we hear about that kind of galvanizes you. It's really horrific. And there's that image of the daughter taking pieces of her father out of her hair afterwards.
Yeah, and then he committed suicide himself with a shotgun. This was my great-grandfather, whom, of course, I had never met and really knew nothing about for a long time after I was an adult and I started learning about these people. When you're a child, you know, there are many, many stories around the periphery of your life that you're parents are telling one another, and there are secrets that are not being articulated, but you sort of pick them up. And so I was sort of picking up things all through my life. And then after my grandmother died, my biographer, Greg Johnson, a very nice young man, began doing research into my family, and he traveled around upstate New York and looked at court records and interviewed people, including older people. And he sort of discovered things that I did not know about that were really not that surprising to me because I sort of knew about them in a kind of half-conscious way.
It's almost like the bass line that's going through the music that you don't concentrate on.
That's right.
If you're listening to the melody.
That's right. And so what I really wanted to do, and it's so thrilling to me even now to think about it, I wanted to give life again to my grandmother, and I wanted to dramatize the buried life, her hidden life, that no one knew about, which was very heroic, I thought. She really made herself into, as I said, a quintessential grandmother. She was very American in the sense that she was upbeat and optimistic. She took really good care of her hair. She had her hair done. She did her fingernails. She dressed very well. And yet inside, she must have been so lonely. Like her heart must have been broken, you know, coming from this background. But she never complained, and she always had a smile. And I think of that as being heroic.
There's such a sense of secrets and shame and vulnerability going through the book. And then also that other side of, well, we've come through that. The main character, Rebecca, makes that kind of conscious choice to be upbeat and heroic in her own life. Do you see those two pieces as linked, that ability to deal with the private secrets and shame and yet put on a public face?
Well, often in literature, when you have a character who's pretending to be something that she isn't or remakes herself, it's suggested that this is a very tragic thing. I don't seem to think that way because I come from the sort of background where there's no point in continuing that life that you had, which was perhaps tragic or at least not very elevating. There's no point in continuing that and wallowing in it. I would rather reinvent a personality and move into a different future or travel to some different part of the country and take on a new voice. And much of remaking oneself is being educated. I was the first person in my family just to graduate from high school, so I represented for them a real advance. You know, they're really real great advance. And now, miraculously enough, I'm at Princeton where I'm a professor. So just in my one lifetime, I've sort of gone from such extremes. And then my grandmother, of course, was in this almost primitive life that she was living, where she was in fear of her life. And yet she sort of, in a way, she gave birth to my father. My father is my father. And just within two generations has been such a, you could call it, a cultural progress. And I consider it really an extraordinary adventure that's very American.
That's just was going to be my next question. This feels so American. This feels like the American story of coming from one kind of place and choosing to be something else.
Yes. And then when Rebecca is quite, she's quite established in her new life, she marries a man who's really a wonderful man. He's a wonderful man. He's well-to-do. And at some point, they go and live in Florida, and he's retired. And she's living there, and now she's really isolated because there's nobody like herself. So she starts writing to her cousin, whom she had never met. And the two women are like sisters, very close, even closer than cousins. And they write these letters that bring tears to my eyes because my own grandmother never had that experience. I don't think she ever had anyone with whom she could speak so openly. So I was giving sort of re-giving life to my grandmother who had been so lonely and imagining a woman like her who did have a sister and did have this close relationship. And how sad it is because, of course, they're getting older and they have shared memories. And at the very end of the novel, it seems that one of them is going to go and visit the other. You know, and you can only hope that they do get together.
Yes, I found those letters the most powerful part of the book. As Rebecca is getting older and she reaches out to this cousin who's like a sister but whom she had never met, and this was someone she thought had died in the Nazi extermination camps. So there is this unexpected sense. Her name is Freda, and there actually is a young girl named Frida in the book, too. And at first I thought, oh, Frida is the one who's going to bring that back into her life. And then you bring the actual Freda
back into her
life.
Well, it's very touching. Even though I wrote it myself, I still feel very touched by it because it does draw upon something that was once very real.
In the book, and now it has different resonance knowing that your grandmother gave you a toy piano. A toy typewriter. One of the things that happens when Rebecca decides to become someone else, she escapes a brutal marriage and she becomes Hazel Jones, and she tells everyone that her little 3-year-old son is a musician, that there's music in him, that this is going to be his life. And it's almost as if she wills him to become an extraordinary pianist. So it's not just the self-reinvention, but it sounds like even in your own life, that sense of there is possibility here for you. You are going to be great at this.
Yes, and she makes so many sacrifices for him, and she's always looking out for him. And it's the way a writer is, where you're always looking for material, and you're very eager, and you do things that are, somebody else might think we're a little strange, you know. You go way out of your way and you spend a lot of time researching something that you might use in a very small way. And there's a sort of leaping or vaulting excitement in creativity. It's quite irrational. She has a feeling that her son can be a pianist because her mother had been. And one of the happiest times with her mother is they're listening to the radio, which is they're not supposed to listen to because the father didn't want them to listen to the radio. And they hear a Beethoven sonata. And all that's bound up with my own life because I played piano and my grandmother paid for my piano lessons and I was playing that same sonata when I was a young pianist. And so it's, in a way, part of my own life.
Radio is throughout this book. There is a sense of radio being a connection to a world outside of this very desolate little life that this family has.
Oh, radio is absolutely transforming. Radio is very important in our farmhouse.
Was it true when you were growing
absolutely.
Up also?
Absolutely. The radio was put on right in the morning. And I remember the radio as a physical object with a little kind of glowing
dial.
And I could sort of see the dial and the special number, the numerals and so forth, and the Buffalo radio stations. It's all part, deeply imprinted in my memory, very important.
What was it that your family listened to?
Well, we listened to news and we listened to the Buffalo stations. You have to remember that this was a somewhat primitive society and there weren't very many stations. There were probably like three or four, and so there wasn't really much. And NBC or something like that.
I think there's WNED in
something like
in,
that.
Buffalo also, which I think there's a public radio station, although I don't know whether or what it was broadcasting when you were a kid.
No, I doubt that it was.
Did you listen
there.
To music on the radio too?
Yes, I listened to music a lot. We had the radio on all day long. Then when television came along, television was more for the evening, where people would actually sit down and look at the television, whereas the radio was your companion. And you are not necessarily sitting and listening to the radio or doing other things. So like making dinner or just housework or reading or walking around the house. The radio was a constant companion in a way that television never was.
I'm speaking with Joyce Carol Oates about her book, The Grave Digger's Daughter, which is published in paperback by Echo. I love that image, and I think radio, it's interesting, and it's partly because I love radio and have been in it for all these years, but I think radio still functions as that for
Absolutely.
So many people, as that
yes.
kind of companion through life that isn't a kind of appointment, I've got to watch this show,
yes.
but is, I want somebody to keep me company while I'm doing these other parts of my life.
Oh, yes, radio is about voice and the familiar voices that you become fond of. You feel affection for, they're like family. The voices, whereas the television people, it's more like they're telling stories. It's more artificial. And the radio people are more like your family.
Yeah, in fact, when I was first starting in radio, people would ask me what people would look like that I knew. And I would say, do you really want to know? Because I think
it's
partly our imagination that we want.
So true.
We've had our listeners reading your book over the past month, and we have a question now from a listener. We have John in Paramus. John, do you have a question for Joyce Carol Oates?
Well, you just talking about radio, that's why baseball on the radio is so much better than it is on television.
My husband would totally agree with you, yes.
Good.
Because you can do things, because the game could be on, and you can be doing chores around the house and outdoors, and then all of a sudden the bases get loaded, you stop for a minute, find out what happens, and you go back to doing it.
Yeah.
And what my husband would say is,
take the picture too.
It's in your head.
Yes.
Yeah, you're imagining.
That's why radio was so fascinating. I'm fascinated by this book. I really have to look at it. And I've read a lot of Joyce Carol Oates' essays. And then obviously, she's a very gifted writer. I mean, that's what I think. I just had one question. Are you still interested in boxing?
Yes, I'm not as interested as I was when I was writing my book, but the book came out like in 1987. But then
you wrote some essays on boxing too that I've read.
Yeah, so. And I wrote essays on Muhammad Ali and Mike Tyson. Yes,
because the state of boxing is now nowhere near. But I mean, I don't know if a lot of people know that. I know they know you're a great writer, but you have a great interest in boxing. So.
Well, when they're great boxers, you really want to write about them.
And there are no more great boxers.
What is it about boxing that caught your imagination, and why, when there are great boxers, do you feel you must write about them?
Well, it wasn't really that anything caught my imagination, but my father took me to Golden Gloves boxing matches when I was a little girl, about 10 or 11 or 12, in Buffalo, New York. So I was sort of catapulted into this extraordinary, overwhelming, exciting, kind of scary, masculine environment in Buffalo, where I was one of very few females, and I was just a little girl, and it was very dramatic. So I didn't have any thoughts about it. I mean, today, of course, I'm a feminist and something of an intellectual, you could say. So I deconstruct and I analyze things, but that was not the case when I was 11. You know, I was basically like Alice in Wonderland, being taken to this somewhat horrific, but all the galvanizing experience. And then after that, I became interested in boxing more as part of history, American history. And my father would watch the Friday night fights. And so it's all bound up with my father and masculinity in America. I guess I sound sort of intellectual now. But at the time, it was just sort of a very potent element in life.
It's interesting, too, connecting it to this book as well. In this book, there are men who beat women, and there are also men like Rebecca/Hazel's husband who don't embody masculinity in the way people wanted them to at that moment, but are the giving, loving people that Hazel needs in her life.
Yes, Hazel. Rebecca becomes Hazel. As Rebecca, she has a certain kind of husband, though it's doubtful that they were really married.
They were really married.
She was sort of tricked into thinking she was married. And he's the archetypal masculine man of a certain era. He's very physical. But when he doesn't have his job anymore, when he's not able to provide financially, then he starts to disintegrate. He drinks. He doesn't have any inner resources. He doesn't have any intelligence. But then her second husband is very civilized. He's a jazz enthusiast. He's the son of a very wealthy industrialist. And he is a genuinely good man. So I was really happy that the woman who was my grandmother, that she could be provided with a man of a kind that I personally would like very much.
In this book, there are so many secrets. And these secrets go down through generations. The secret of Rebecca's Jewish heritage is something that her parents even refused to talk about and refused to let them even mention the word Jew, although it becomes visited on them when people draw swastikas on their home. Even her son is someone who is trying to figure out, who am I and where am I in this world? Was that something that you struggled with also when you found out these things about your grandmother that you hadn't known before?
Well, it was so interesting. Now, in the novel, Rebecca's son, Zach, never really discovers that he's Jewish, but he becomes extremely interested in Judaism. And he falls in love with a Jewish girl. And he's interested in some of the questions of the Old Testament. You know, it's almost as if there is this primeval genetic gravitation toward his background. And, of course, Rebecca is astonished by this because it's the one thing she didn't want anybody to know about, as her father didn't. And people have to understand that to come from Europe in the 1890s or in the 1930s, to get away from Europe, people who were Jewish might very well just want to begin all over again though it doesn't work, and it's not maybe a good idea, you can see why they would want to begin all over again and not have the memory of this terrible discrimination and pogroms, and just to put it all behind them. So my great-grandparents settled in upstate New York, where there were no Jews. They could have settled in New York or Boston, where the big Jewish communities, they would have had friends and neighbors. But they moved to this faraway place in upstate New York where there were no Jews, you know, and almost no civilization. I mean, really very little up there. And then they just, I think, just disintegrated. I mean, they didn't have any culture.
And when you found this out, you said it wasn't a surprise, even though it wasn't something that had ever been explicitly told to you.
Yes, I think that's true. I felt there was some tragedy or something mysterious there. So my grandmother never talked about herself. You know, most older people talk about nothing else except their memories. You know, they have all these stories. People's eyes glaze over listening to them. My grandmother was not like that at all. She didn't have any stories. So that seemed a little odd.
One of our listeners wrote in and said that some people say that your stories are dark. Would you consider this a dark story?
Well, to me, it was very exciting. It's tragic and tumultuous, and it's like a Shakespearean play in the sense that you have all these emotions and you're having a great adventure. Unlike the Shakespearean tragedy, though, which ends in death, the novel does not end in death, but it ends with a woman transforming herself. I mean, there's one day when she gets her hair cut and she gets maybe her hair dyed a little and she's done something with her makeup and she basically has changed her whole manner. She's smiling differently. She's moving her hands. She sort of made herself into a new person instead of continuing with the old life and maybe dying, you know, coming to the end of an old life. I thought that was very, very inventive.
And she has to let go of even the good parts of who she was and the good parts of her past, but in order to be able to inhabit this new role that she entirely creates for herself.
Yes, but the one thing that you never recreate or reinvent is a camaraderie of the past. I remember when we were very poor, I was friendly with a girl next door, and we played Parcheesi on her kitchen table. And there were really wonderful memories of being girls and visiting this very poor family. And that stays with me all my life. So when Rebecca is the wife of a well-to-do man, she's staying at a very fancy hotel in San Francisco, she goes down into the bowels of the hotel, and she wants to see the people who work in the kitchen because she once been a chambermaid in a hotel, which my grandmother had done too.
Oh, really?
And,
wow.
And so she has this camaraderie with the workers in a hotel who are back behind the scenes, and she wants to go in and be with them. And so she plays cards with them back in the kitchen. At first they don't want her to come in because they don't think she belongs, but then it sort of turns out she really can relate to these people who work in the kitchen. And I think people who work in kitchens and restaurants and hotels have a real camaraderie with one another. And they're putting on a show for the customers who are usually well-to-do.
That scene was very powerful, too, because you can see that she feels it's as if she's learning how to inhabit different worlds. And when she needs strength, she goes back to a world that's familiar in order to draw the strength to be able to inhabit Hazel Jones again and become that person in the world.
Yes, I have a novel called Because It's Bitter and Because It Is My Heart about a girl who comes from a neighborhood. She lived in a black neighborhood or integrated. In those days, it was a Negro neighborhood, you know, they're very poor. Then she moves up socially, and she's at a party, and there are black servants. The people in white uniforms, and they're carrying...
I'm sorry, I have to jump in, but I realize we're out of time. This has been such a wonderful conversation.
Sorry.
I've been speaking with Joyce Carol Oates about her novel, The Gravedigger's Daughter, which is published by Echo. It was this month's pick for the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club. Joyce, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.